Today's program is brought to you by our neighbors, Fine and Raw Chocolate, producers of the most delicious bean-to-bar chocolates in Brooklyn. For more information, visit fineandraw.com.
Hey, this is Hannah Forden. I'm the program manager here at Heritage Radio Network. This year, we're celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary, and I want to thank all of our listeners and members for being a part of an incredible year of food radio. We never would have made it this far without all of you. So HRN is now in its summer fun drive, and this is when we turn to you and ask that you make a donation to help ensure a bright future for food radio. Whether you listen to one show or 20, there's a reason why you keep tuning in week after week. All of our content is powered by a small nonprofit, and we rely on your generosity to keep going. Help us keep broadcasting the most thought-provoking, entertaining, and educational conversations happening in the world of food and beverage. So become a member today. To celebrate our 10th anniversary, we have some brand new member gifts available online, so I encourage you to snag your new favorite pizza-themed t-shirt or enamel pin today and show the world how much you love HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate so you can snag your 10th anniversary member swag. And thank you.
This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network. Today is Thursday, June 27th. I'm Emily Pearson, and I'm here with my co-host, Brandon Hoy.
Did the intro song get longer?
It felt like it was a few really extra long. Seconds.
Felt way more epic this morning.
Well, way more epic, and it makes you think of TV, like as though I was doing my last little bit of makeup and powder before they like...
The funny thing is I was.
You were, yeah. I know. So was Eric from Alameda. He was putting pants on, right, Eric?
Right. Oh, I was just getting him on now. One leg at a time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, as always, we have Eric Koss of the Alameda Sun, a newspaper out in California, joining us. We also have Aaron Silva, a team member from Heritage Foods in the house.
Good morning, everybody.
And then we have our special guest for the Weekly Grill, our chef Darren Carbone, executive chef of Elvez, part of the Star Restaurant Empire here on the East Coast. And we also have Rachel from his social media team joining us in the studio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And we have a special call-in, James Wetlore of Cabrito and our Gotober partner calling in from Trinidad. James, are you there?
Oh, wait. No, that was the wrong button. Sorry, James.
Yeah, I'm here. Well, from Port of Spain in Trinidad, where it's about 32 degrees at 9 in the morning.
I need a translation. What's 32 degrees? Like 90?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, about 90.
All right.
Warm. Just beautiful.
Awesome. We have we luckily have that weather here too. So we're going to pretend like we're in Trinidad hanging out with the goat spit with you.
Well, I'm also drinking rum at 10 o'clock in the morning. So
I know.
Kind of like Trinidad.
Exactly.
You're getting character, Brandon. You're getting character.
We've got the Caribbean rum vibe going over here. All right, so we are going to jump into our weekly base segment. I have a question for everyone. We're going to go around the room, say who you are, please. Name the single ingredient that has played the biggest role in your life or career thus far. James, you want to start?
Well, I should say goat, I suppose, considering that I get and turn into a goat supplier full time. But if I wasn't going to say that, I'd probably garlic, right? Garlic or onions, which are the basis of pretty much all European food.
He took mine.
So I probably spend more time than I'd like to imagine peeling garlic or onions. But I should probably say goat because I'm in Trinidad. Talking, I'm about to go butcher a goat. So
all right, goat rub down.
Goat man, so I will say goat.
Goat rub down with garlic. I think that's your final answer there, Brandon. What do you got?
I mean, mine would be flour, most likely.
Okay.
Yeah, I would have to say flour.
We powdered you with some flour before we went live.
You know my love for bread, too. So I'm going to have to say flour.
Okay. Chef, Darren?
I'd have to go with corn.
You know, I know it can be politically not the correct thing these days, but like corn.
Because there's so political versatile. Correct corn. We don't know where it is.
It doesn't
Eric.
Exist anymore.
I mean, Eric, call it maize, if anyone maybe. Knows where there's politically correct corn, Eric does.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, you got to call it maize.
Oh, right.
Oh,
and
sorry.
Then
maize.
You're being politically yeah. correct, yeah. yeah. Or whatever. I'm probably saying it wrong.
We won't hold anybody to their exact sourcing of where their corn comes from, but yeah. we suspect you've got some good yeah. stuff over there.
Very versatile
this.
Stuff, yes.
Single ingredient. I always say cheese. Today
I'm just going to say.
I always
say
it. All right, fine. All right.
Come on.
Patrick made me officially dissect my answer the other day off the air. He's like, let's face it. He's like, you love pizza because you love the single ingredients, but really what you love is cheese. And I was like, okay, thank you for my therapy session.
Cheese is a single ingredient, right?
Cheese is a single ingredient. Absolutely. Aaron, you got one for us?
Yeah, I would say lemons, maybe. I really wanted to say garlic, but I feel like I learned from an early age that you can't go wrong with lemon, like in a vinaigrette. It's very good for you. It's got health benefits. I'm going to go with lemon.
I hear you're supposed to drink a glass of lemon water every morning. It's supposed to help with digestion.
Who but told you this?
It might have been like the a internet. Diet blog website.
Oh, right.
But then
I want to know how yeah. credible the source
but then
is.
Then my best friend who's a dentist told me not to because
no,
it's bad for your
idea.
Teeth.
It's horrible for your
the,
teeth.
It rips all the enamel off your teeth. Oh, I was so, like, whoever told you this doesn't care about your
they have veneers.
Dental hygiene.
They
I
don't
know.
Need their teeth anymore.
That blogger who just
well,
wanted to help.
Everything sums up the mixed messages that we get from food.
I know. That's true. What's best with lemons?
It's one of the big problems, I think, you know, that people, you read this stuff, somebody says they're an expert, this thing's good for you, someone else tells you this thing's good for you, you just don't know where to stand. I mean, you just guess you strip back to the principles of buying good food and cooking it yourself and you'll be all right.
Right, and having a diverse, yep. like, I don't think there's just one thing yeah. that you could stick to that's gonna make everything better for you. So diversity is also yep. is also helpful in your diet.
All right, I am going to segue into a favorite question here. A quick game of fuck, marry, kill.
Oh,
I hope
God.
I don't regret it.
Do we
but
have
it's
to play this every
yes,
day?
But it's in honor. It's in honor of Darren and James. They are both great supporters of all things goat and Goatober. Darren has a special on tonight at Alves on the Trompo. They brought in some goat legs, and it's a pretty cool dish that you can. Have a little bit of goat woven into your, you know, into your palate and have a great burrito. So I'm going to go with livestock as the theme. Goat, lamb, pork.
No, I'm not talking about fucking any animals. Wait. Like, why do we,
no.
why does this
okay,
all
about,
boil down to
Mary,
me have to
about,
tell you what animal I'm willing to fuck?
Right. I was going to say fuck in terms of like, yeah, I don't want it.
Yeah,
like,
I'm okay with that.
Know,
we don't
that
have, yeah, we can go with fuck that.
But,
okay.
But I want to stir a little bit of controversy here because there seems to be like a discrepancy out there in the record about which type of animal is eaten more widely across the world, goats or pigs. And some people like to claim that
goat,
it's goats,
isn't it?
But I think the actual truth is that it's pigs. I don't know. I was just having this discussion with my girlfriend
James?
This morning at 5 a.m.
The Chinese eat a lot
because of you guys.
James, what'd you say?
But, yeah.
The Chinese eat a lot of pork, and there's a lot of Chinese. I've looked into this, obviously, because it's something that people say to me all the time, and it depends how you measure it. If you measure it in terms of like
poundage
per
yeah.
human consumed, mm. yes. then it, yeah, then it's pork by miles, according to the World Health Organization. But if you uh-huh. if you count it as what is a constituent of your diet in terms of meat. Then goat might be right, but the World Health Organization says it's pork, then chicken, then goat, then beef.
Is
goat,
it wouldn't it
chicken,
be diversity of culture? Like diversity of culture would probably be goat.
I guess so, but then at the end of the day,
right.
poundage, you know, a goat is much smaller than
yes,
a pig or
poundage.
A cow.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, mm-hmm. if we're talking about packing the pounds. So
pork's big problem is that even if you treat it really badly, it still grows. So you can actually farm it in really bad conditions, as you guys know, and produce it really efficiently. And that is also another reason why it is. That's why pork and chicken are the most consumed, because they're easily farmed, even if those farming methods are atrocious and terrible and should be banned.
But doesn't goat, I mean, don't they live on mountains? I mean, that's pretty...
Isn't that
pretty,
the reason you
yeah.
want to marry
yeah,
it? Aren't they playful and they live on the mountain?
Here we go.
And you can do goat yoga, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's
you
not
know,
large
where they climb
farming.
On your back.
all right, guys, I'm going to fuck a chicken. So let's just get out and, like, let's just get this off
the
table.
That's not even on the list.
It wasn't a choice, but that's okay. All right, we can move on. James, I know you have to hop off the line. So really quickly, will you just, you're calling in from Trinidad. Can you let us know what's going on there and what's going on for GoTober 2019?
Yeah. First of all, I'd fuck pork, I'd marry goat, and I'd avoid lamb. But I'm kind of already married to goat, but we're in Trinidad at the moment because we're launching Trinidad GoTober, GoTober TNT, Trinidad and Tobago. I did some TV this morning on the National News Network. I'm about to butcher a goat for the Goat Breeders Association, for the Sheep and Goat Breeders Association. The idea is, obviously, the Caribbean has a real reputation of eating goat a lot, but they only cook it one way, and what they're trying to do is expand the market for goat meat, take it into the restaurants and take it into the hotels by offering more than just sliced on-the-bone goat meat for curries, which really limits the amount of money they can make from a product that they spend a lot of time and effort rearing. So we're here to promote that. Also, we're going to join all of the information together, including you guys in New York and here and in Australia and all across Europe. And that's all coming together under the website that's being launched in the next couple of weeks, GoTober.com, which will have information about GoTober events all over the world. We're taking it, new countries that we're taking it to this year, obviously the Caribbean, but also Australia. We've got five restaurants in Melbourne joining in. We've got a couple in Sydney joining in. So it really has continued to expand across the world. And that is also, that also includes further expansion in Europe. We're doing events in Holland, Belgium, France. And we're also, really excitingly, we're taking GoTober to the Sheep Festival in Bra on the 28th of September. So very early for kind of an early GoTober, but we are taking it to the Sheep Festival. So we're taking it right into the belly of the beast. There will be all of these French goat farmers, Dutch goat farmers, basically European goat farming royalty will all be there. They're all coming to a dinner that we're cooking and trying to get them to, you know, turn the tanker in terms of euthanizing these billies, try and get all those people in one room and see if we can't make some progress. So the Bra thing, the Cheese Festival in Bra, is really exciting. But also, it's exciting from a personal level, because I went 10 years ago as a punter and, like, loved it, and now we're there representing GoTober and a change in their industry, which is what we're trying to achieve, just trying to stop people euthanizing these animals, put them into the food system, appreciating them for the, you know, goat has always had a very second-class kind of image, and we're just trying to raise that image, and that's part of what we're doing here, but that's definitely what we're doing in Bra, the big kit GoTober off. So there's so much happening with GoTober this year. We've also got a restaurant that we booked out for the entire month in London, and TJ Steele from Clyro's coming over to cook. We've got him for a week. And then we've got Jesse Gerner, who's the guy who's got the five restaurants in Melbourne that are doing GoTober. He's coming over to London to cook. And then we've got Henrik Dierendonck, who's got a Michelin star John Carcass in Belgium, and he's coming for a week. So that's a kind of standalone event, that GoTober's kind of first standalone event that doesn't involve me or doesn't involve Heritage Foods. So it's kind of branching out. That's being managed by that restaurant. They're doing all their own media. So there's starting to be events where I'm not involved and Heritage Foods aren't involved as it grows. And we have a kind of oversight just to make sure everybody's doing it the right way.
Awesome.
And going to the right places. But it just shows how it's expanding. And that's all coming together under GoTober.com. Which should be
GoTober.com. It's launching, I believe, for sure by the end of July. And obviously everyone can hear more about all the events that James just mentioned for October 2019, but starting end of September in Bra, which is a really cool, cheese is the big event put on by Slow Food every other year in Bra in Italy. So that should be awesome.
And it was Patrick made that.
Yes, Patrick who's on vacation today and not with us in studio. We will make sure...
Patrick's on vacation every day. He may physically be here at times, but let's just be honest.
He's on vacation. Got it. James, have fun in Trinidad. Get a tan while you're there, and everyone be sure to check out GoTober.com. And then, if you're craving a little goat tonight, check out Elvez. And then Darren always brings in goats for GoTober. So we will be talking more GoTober. James, we'll talk to you later.
Yeah, thanks. Cheers, everyone. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. So we're gonna jump back in, but that was awesome. And GoTober's a really cool program, and we're excited for everyone who participates.
Did we talk about the 10th anniversary of Heritage Radio Summer Drive?
No, but would you like to?
Well, new members get gifts, right? If you go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate, you can become a member and receive a new gift, a new limited edition enamel pin. It's a slice of pizza that says HRN. Very cute. I would like one for my pocket currently. I actually can't see what the other things say because I'm not wearing my glasses, but they look like amazing gifts. And if you're not a member, you should become a member.
Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Get my plugs in.
Nice job, Brandon. Nice job. All right. We are, I'm going to circle back to our next topic here. This Tuesday, June 25th, was the first official Bourdain Day. On what would have been his 63rd birthday, people from across the food world came together to remember author and TV host Anthony Bourdain. Do any of you have a story you'd like to share? Or if not, who are your mentors? What's one lesson you carry with you through any new project? Darren?
Well, I remember coming up as a cook way back when and reading his book. And I wouldn't say I went to the extremes like here. Like, they sounded like pirates when you read Kitchen Confidential for the first time.
Like, you would put that book next to Motley Crue, The Dirt, more than you would put it next to, like, you know, a Daniel Boulud.
Except there were no hot chicks in the kitchen, no money getting tossed around. Drugs, probably plenty.
Lots.
Yeah, lots, lots. But, and I remember thinking, you know, this was the life. Like, you enjoyed the camaraderie and it had like this feeling of like what a real kitchen felt like coming up as a line cook. And so, I mean, it was probably the first like kind of biographical thing that I ever read on cooking. And it spoke to me in a way that was just honest, the way that like he presented himself on TV, you know? So, and as far as mentors, I mean, I was lucky enough that the guys that I knew were very focused and very professional in the way that Kitchen Confidential is the other end of it. So that's
how
we were as
line cooks. You got to read about
the
fun and the aspirational stuff that like maybe you wanted to dip your toe into, but then you were like, I'm working for the real.
We had good nights as line cooks, you do. But when you move up the food chain, like I feel like you kind of have to put in order to be successful, you have to put a little bit of that behind.
I feel like in a lot of, you know, new professionalism, like those things don't exist. You think back, like even in sports, like the good old days of baseball camaraderie and like kitchen camaraderie that just like that doesn't exist. And I don't think it's necessarily for the worse, because a lot of it was like circled around pretty bad habits. Mostly alcoholism, drug abuse, misogyny, a lot of things that the world is probably better without, right?
Oh yeah.
But you still like you still read those things and kind of get a glimpse into like you know glamorizing this like kind of wild craziness that just doesn't really exist in kitchens too much these days.
No, it would be the detriment to the restaurant. And at the end of the day, it's already hard enough to make a dollar. And if you have nothing but degenerates, there's always a couple. But if you have nothing but degenerates, it doesn't help your cause.
And what do you guys think? I mean, like dry kitchens, is that a thing now? Or most like do line cooks get to like have a beer at the end of the night? Or
we stopped doing it a while ago. I mean, it was weird because it kind of became like a reward system, like Pavlov's dog. Like at the end of the night, if they did a good job, we would do beers on ice. When I was at Alma, we would do that. And then we like kind of gave that up, and I made the mistake of, all right, well, we'll get Gatorades and, you know, and power drinks. And it was like people went bananas about halfway through the night. And I'm like, yeah, we got to not give them caffeine. You know, that's not the way to go. It's not quite the same effect. So, but yeah, so we don't do it anymore, but you know, it's the game has changed.
Yeah. And I think that there's a younger generation of kids that don't look at alcohol as the reward. And
right.
I think like psychologically, we're moving into a place that's just better, you know, for young professionals. So though it is Pavlov's dog, right? It's that end of the night. It's the reward that I get this thing. But also, like, what are we teaching these young professionals by doing it? You know, we're saying, hey, you do a great job, and, like, your reward is you get to go get sloppy drunk, and, like, who knows if you come to work tomorrow.
Right.
And then most people go out after the shift drink, and then it's just service is not right the next day.
I know. And if they already have a buzz when they go out for their like drinks at the end of the night, then forget it. You're never seeing them tomorrow. They're calling out.
On a probably not enlightening note, one of my wife's longtime sous chefs, like what you're talking about is exactly right. Because when you see it in the business and how detrimental it is for someone's career and for someone's life, we had my wife's old sous chef passed away from alcoholism like 3 weeks ago.
Right.
And 20 years she worked with this guy, and to watch them cook together, she ran a small restaurant here in New York called Sueños, and it was beautiful to watch them cook together and to see him fall down that slippery slope and not be able to find his way out. Like, those are the days that are glorified in a book like that, and kind of the lifestyle that Anthony Bourdain like perpetuated, I feel like.
But his TV shows.
But also was like a huge part of his misery, right?
Right, and, absolutely.
And like a lot of that stuff like carried on into his life and you know, probably led to some of the unhappiness, right? So again, I think like as business owners and as leaders, like sometimes you have to find more motivating ways than just to
Release. It's not about the release.
Yeah, it's about the greatness of what you are and
or
what
the
you,
goal that you're trying to attain.
Yeah,
you know?
Hey, it's at the end, after the process, it's what was produced. And if you put out a night's worth of beautiful food, that should be the reward.
Yeah,
you should be able to look at yourself and say, I made all of these people happy. The reward shouldn't be like, now let's go get fucking hammered.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a different ball game in that regard. So, yeah, I don't see that much anymore. And the places that do, it's, you know, they're archaic in their approach.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
I'd just like to reference the fact that I kind of came through to Bourdain through his show Parts Unknown. And I was really fascinated to, like, all of the deep, rich ways that food, you know, feeds into all the other kinds of culture and people's lives. And one of the things that was, like, carried through was that some of the old ways of cooking are being lost. Like, families are not passing on their food traditions because they're not as economically viable as going out and becoming a doctor or a lawyer or something. Running a restaurant is, like, frowned upon. So some old recipes and stuff are just being completely lost. So I thought that was really great that he brought that out with his show.
Yeah, I think one of the great things about that show specifically too is it kind of shows that like food and beverage is the vascular system of like humanity. Everything like everything travels with it. It's a cultural thing that like can travel all around the whole globe, and it keeps people united, and it kind of brings people together. And I think he did such a great job of really like showing that and bringing that to light, that this is such that food is such an important piece of culture across the world.
Yeah, the culture was, I feel like on his show, was celebrated through food, and it shows synonymously how interwoven our lives are with really great food and the experience that goes along with that.
I think he also showed a lot of Americans all the culture they were missing out on by not trying foods that they weren't familiar with, and I loved how his show was just not eating. Like he always went out and did some, you know, got drinks or whatever, and you always felt like, man, he would be a really fun person to hang out with. I also I'm from Cape Cod, and I remember hearing that in Kitchen Confidential, one of his first jobs was in Provincetown. So
that was the one that I was referencing.
Yeah, when I first learned about that, I felt like a deeper connection, I guess, to him in some way. And I think that his show really propelled my interest in food like even further. And that's when I kind of got addicted to food shows and travel food shows. And
I think that's when he got addicted along the way too. He said that his like mentor, but I don't know, the guy was like constant. I remember reading that part of the book, like his mentor was constantly like drunk and on drugs, but he was like this guy that he still like looked up to and admired because he like how quickly could he shuck oysters and just like the flavors and things that he was learning from him.
It was just a different world. I got my first sous chef position by my head chef just didn't show up for weeks because he was smoking crack. So and it's just like this like in the 90s, this was just it was really just kind of how the industry was. And it's nice that it's changed a little bit, but it was like you read those stories, and I actually like cooked in an era when this was kind of prevalent, and it's I'm kind of glad that it's all gone. Yeah. To be honest, yeah, with
the
you,
the chef's lifestyle is not easy. I mean,
it was hard.
You're up late. You're living like opposite hours as most people. Except
the pay was not
industry.
Good.
Pay is
there was
not
no
good.
Celebrity. Like you just
well, the
'90s
it was not the celebrity.
There was
component.
No.
It was
there was
blue
no,
collar, not white collar.
And there was no the ceiling was low. So it was like, what was the greatest you were gonna be as a chef? You were gonna be the executive chef or the head chef of some place, maybe a hotel group. Like it just the dreams were different then.
It was a lifestyle.
It was
like
a lifestyle.
Much like it is now, but now that lifestyle affords you a lot more opportunity than it ever.
Totally.
Did back then.
And with social media and just the idea that like you could possibly take it to a greater place financially and just like could support a lifestyle that you have, that those things just didn't exist then. So it was really just like you grinded, you worked hard, and you played hard.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you were always aspiring, to be at the top of a high-end hotel and to wear super formal chef whites and a toque. It wasn't this idea that like a Brooklyn hole in the wall or something with 12 seats or Blanca 20 course meal here in Bushwick could be something that was a vision. But so I want to just segue to that. We were talking about Americans versus, you know, and Anthony Bourdain opening our eyes to other cultures. So the world's 50 best restaurant list was just released from San Pellegrino. And of the top 50, only 6 of those restaurants were in the U.S. So we often talk about ascending and descending food cities here, but what about countries? Like, are we way behind?
So I thought about this, right? And what I saw is they changed the rules, though, on it this year, because anyone who had finished number one was no longer allowed to be on the list. So so that changes the rules a little bit. So like a restaurant like Alinea, they're not on the list now. So, because they want to open it up for new restaurants. At least that's what I read. I could be wrong, but that's why like the list changes had changed so drastically this year, because they want to open it up for new restaurants.
But
so it's not
list,
the same restaurants
but
on the list.
This list typically is a moving target.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
There's nothing you could do as a chef or an owner of a restaurant to solidify your place on this list.
Right.
So, it is completely like up to
at the mercy of other people.
And what are their agenda?
Do they want to be somewhere like shiny and clean and sparse, and like, is this year the year of the like very clean lines and Spartan dining room, and we love everything that Copenhagen is doing, and like that's why it's going
to
be at the top?
Eric, I'd love to hear your take on this, because as somebody who has the power to influence people through journalism, like this is a place here where like, one, you never know what their agenda is, but also you know how influential it is.
Well, you know, I am definitely not the same stripe of journalist as many of them, because a lot of them are really aware of the power they have to manipulate people and actually use it, maybe, perhaps. But I don't think that we necessarily think of it that way here at my paper. But anyway, to your point, I think this world's 50 best restaurant list is really just intended to promote restaurants in general. And by creating that new rule that Darren just mentioned, I think the point is just to get more restaurants out there in front of the audience that they have so that they can promote more people and be relevant to more restaurants. I don't know. See, a lot of times it's like just trying to reach as many different audiences as possible now, because audiences are so fragmented, and if each restaurant has its own social media group and its own network that this magazine or whatever is producing this thing can tap into, then they've reached that much more of an audience. So I don't know.
I wonder if they feel some sort of social like responsibility to like, you know, like you said, just to restaurant groups in general, or restaurants in general, just like keeping the camaraderie alive and in the restaurant business and all over. I wonder if they really sit around and they're thinking like.
What I thought was ironic about this list this year, though, is so Noma comes in at number 2 on the list, and because of this rule, technically they reopened this year, even though they've been the best restaurant in the world like five out of the like last 8 years. They're allowed to be on the list because they had closed and reopened. But to me, like they were still number one. It's an offshoot of what they were, but they're still ostensibly the same restaurant.
Yeah, I closed for Thanksgiving too.
But then going back to Bourdain, what was cool is he was always featuring these places around the world that were lowbrow, that were for everybody. Yep. He went to Vietnam and sat on the little blue stools. Like it was not about it being like most of this list, most people can't afford to go to these places, let alone get a reservation. I mean, you know, like Massimo Bottura in Italy, I've always wanted to eat at his restaurant, Osteria Francescana. There's a wait list. Yeah. You can't get on it.
You can put this list with like the world's largest yachts.
Yeah.
and like the best tropical islands.
Right. Yes.
Like I could give it's you very, all of the list that fall into this category.
It's Rob Report.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, no, I hear you. So, you know, the thing, other lists, ESPN is making a 30 for 30 documentary on Nathan's hot dog eating contest champions. You know, very apropos coming up on July 4th. The male record holder is an 11-time champ. I guess you're allowed to come back year after year. If you're at the top of the list, you can still come back.
It's a lot of dogs.
He broke his own record by eating 74 hot dogs. This is, by the way, in 10 minutes.
Is this Joey Chestnut?
Isn't that Joey Chestnut?
Yeah.
Yes.
And wait.
His name is bigger than the event.
Let me just say, though, this is not undisputed. Disputed because the Japanese guy who was the champion before him was banned from eating there, and I think he still continues on the 4th of July to do his own against all of them in a live feed, and I think he still to this day beats them.
Do we know why he was banned?
I think he's from out here.
I thought it was because, like, the way, like, he soaks it. I don't know.
It had nothing to do with the competition.
Method?
It had everything to do with advertising. Either he had said something against Nathan's. It had something to do with a dispute between him and Nathan's, I believe. And they banned him from it. But I think this goes undisputed, is my point here. I think he would still say that he is
probably the
champion.
Interesting.
And then on the there's also a female record holder. She's nicknamed the Black Widow. She's a competitive eater. Her record is 45 hot dogs in 10 minutes. And she also holds the world records for tater tots, oysters, and turducken. I don't understand who decided there should be a competition about turducken. She only weighs 98 pounds.
Oh, my God.
And then I read that his secret is most people think when you fast for days before your stomach shrinks and you can eat less, he fasts for 2 to 3 days before.
Anyway. So his system is completely clear.
I know about this sport.
Wheel in the hot dogs. Yeah, we're totally. Going to do it. Emily, go. Brandon, Aaron,
I'll tell
Darren.
You, in 10 minutes, if I could eat three of them, I would be surprised.
I eat like one hot dog a year. That's about it. That's good for me.
I like hot dogs.
I'm a corn dog person.
All right. So. Ooh, there it goes back to corn at the beginning.
Yeah, there we go.
Corn dogs subliminally. Are awesome.
Yeah, I guess.
Should we have a pizza eating contest?
Like right now?
Like right now.
Can we
fire up the pizza oven?
I mean, we can, definitely.
All right.
I don't know if... there's something about like contest and eating that just seems inappropriate to me. We had one here. We had a hot dog eating contest here. And actually for our 4th of July party this year, they tried to get me to bring it back. But I was so physically disgusted by what I watched.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I would never have this again. It's gross. They're just smashing food violently.
Is it weird that every time I think of the contest now, like I watched Stand By Me with my kid last week.
That's all I think about is lard ass.
Lard ass the whole time.
And then just the pukarama. like a chain of projectile vomiting.
Vomiting on the Elks and the Elks through. And it's like, oh my God, that's what I think of.
Brandon, what's this July 4th party? Are we invited?
Yeah, we're having a party here at Roberta's, a carnival theme party. We'll have like a dunk tank and some jugglers or maybe juggalos.
I don't know.
One of the two.
Is Patrick going to be in the dunk tank?
I sure hope so.
Eric, but Patrick's coming out your way. Put him in the dunk tank out in California.
Yeah. We'll find a dunk tank for him.
Or just push him in the water.
Do it. And what's Alves doing for the 4th?
It tends to be pretty light. No. I'm not going to say I wish, but maybe hope.
Okay.
But no, we're open. We'll probably run some specials on that day.
The thing with the, and you could chime in on that, the thing with the 4th of July as a restaurant, it's a very hard day to operate. It's just like, unless you do something, no, people have planned, it's like New Year's.
Right.
Unless you just embrace it and do something, it's a hard day to,
and the fireworks are on the other side of the water from us. Mm-hmm. So like there's not a lot of reason.
Well, I think
to
come both of
there.
Your restaurants have great, you know, July 4th is on a Thursday this year, so it's fall, which means we're off the air next week. Don't cry too much, everybody, but we will be back the week after. But it means it's a 4-day weekend for a lot of people. So I think with the garden at Roberta's, you definitely have that day drinking, hanging out outside mentality. Maybe people actually haven't gone out of town yet.
Trying to stimulate that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
and then Alvez, you open the windows. You've got like, you're kind of
we'll
right
get
off
some
the
influx
Hudson.
Of people who don't want to be part of like what happens on the other side of the water, who don't want to be part of the fireworks show and just want to chill and lay back. That I think we'll get because Battery Park is right next to us. And like you said, it's alfresco dining. It's a great place to be. I just, you know, it tends to be very slow because none of the businesses are open in the area.
And usually you just have like a lot of people that are just trying to get out of New York.
Oh, they're, yeah, like, absolutely.
They're like trying to figure out what the best time of day to leave is, and they're, you know, yeah, everyone's just doing that.
It's an exodus.
I literally changed my plan so I didn't have to try to leave the city on July 4th because it's a nightmare.
Yeah.
But yeah,
it's refreshing actually, how quiet it is here on holidays like that.
But you know why I like it? Because you feel like the city is your city for
it's
that
true.
Day. When it's like waking up at like 5 in the morning and you walk down the road and it's like, dude, this is my city.
Crickets.
You know?
Like a
yeah.
Sunday morning or something.
Yeah,
yes,
perfect
nobody
example.
Around.
Yeah.
That's great.
Now you've heard it here from the New Yorkers. This is the way to feel like it's your city.
Yeah.
Get up a little earlier. Stay on the holidays. Ugh. Eric, go ahead. What were you saying?
Yeah, I just wanted to tell you that my city here, Alameda, is supposedly, I don't know if you guys can refute this or not, but supposedly it has the world's longest July 4th parade at 3.3 miles. It goes completely across our little city, and like one part of the city is completely isolated by the parade. You can't leave for like 4 hours. You're stuck, you know, waiting for the parade to go by. Wow. It has like 150 entries at least, and like 2,500 people involved. Something like 17,000 people watching
commitment.
Along the
I will
parade
not route. Refute that because New York would never do something like that. That sounds like a liability that like Mayor de Blasio is like, I do not want a 3-mile parade anywhere.
Oh my gosh.
Eric, speaking of, right. What's on the cover of the Alameda Sun today?
Well, we had an interesting proposal from a firm that was trying to set up like a mega server for, you know, like a cloud server kind of thing. And it was going to be water cooled because it was going to be like super fast and generate all this heat. And then their plan was just to dump this superheated water into the bay right by this place where we have this particular spot where a bunch of harbor seals like to hang out. On this little concrete platform that they made for them in this whole bit. It's a long story. Yeah, that's a whole nother story. But they want to dump this superheated water just under these seals. And unfortunately, this data firm is going to have to find some other place to do this because Alameda sent them away. Council voted unanimously
Save
to
the
send
seals.
Them away.
One
even
for
though
the
they
seals.
Made
it's like a hot tub. It's like a hot tub for seals.
And the seals love the cold water. That's why they're there.
Oh, yeah.
So they would be like, you know, and then whatever fish that are dwelling there would leave.
Yeah, it's like a sensitive area where they wanted to dump this water. And it just seems to me that, like, if it's a tech firm, they should be smart enough to figure out a better idea than just dumping their waste in the bay. Like, doesn't that sound like so 20th century?
Why don't they just fill up everybody's hot tubs in the bay?
That's what I was going to say. Why don't they open a hot tub place?
Yeah, open a next door, they should have a bathhouse.
Yeah.
So did the paper unfold this? Like, how did they find out? Because that's what's crazy to me and how big business is like, oh, no one thought that out. We just dump it in the ocean. You know, like how did you guys find out about that?
Well, there's a number of environmentalists that are watching this area called Alameda Point where they're trying to redevelop. It's an extremely valuable piece of property with unbelievable views of San Francisco.
Oh, right.
And it's also got a wildlife preserve there for an endangered species called the least tern. So this tiny little bird holds up these gigantic development projects and everything. And then we also have the harbor seals in the mix. So, yeah, it's like, yeah, there's enough environmentalists watching, the Audubon Society and whatnot, and they just didn't want that at all. And Alameda tends to be a little environmentally friendly, so
just a little,
I think
just
the
a
residents were against it, too.
It's what keeps its charm.
Exactly. All right, stick around. We have to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more Darren Carbone from Elvez.
Today's program is brought to you by our neighbors, Fine and Raw Chocolate. They make bean-to-bar chocolate and confections in HRN's backyard here in Brooklyn. Fine and Raw is committed to sustainably sourcing their cocoa beans directly from organic cocoa farmers. They use minimal processing and stone grinding to accentuate chocolate flavor and aroma. Their chocolate is sweetened exclusively with unrefined coconut sugar, which blends delicious caramel notes into the chocolate. Crafted for chocolate lovers, all of Fine & Raw's bars, truffles, and spreads are 100% plant-based. From creamy bars blended with nut butter to salt-sprinkled dark chocolate, sweet truffle bars to toasty coconut dulce de leche, Fine & Raw is obsessed with creating next-level flavors. Their chocolate hazelnut butter made with the best Oregon hazelnuts is the best thing you could ever eat with a spoon. It begs to be drizzled on ice cream, waffles, strawberries, you get the idea. Above all, Fine and Raw is a community of people dedicated to the idea that chocolate is magic. Visit fineandraw.com for your chocolate fix.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Korsha Wilson, and I'm the host of A Hungry Society here on HRN. A Hungry Society focuses on highlighting dope people doing amazing work in food, and we talk about how we can make the culinary world a more diverse and inclusive space. You can join the conversation by checking out A Hungry Society wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back. This is the Main Course OG, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. James Wetlore, who was with us earlier, had to jump off the line before the break to go butcher a goat in Trinidad. We are here with Chef Darren Carbone of Elvez, New York City. Hey, Chef. So I found an article in InStyle magazine titled Six Culinary Couples Reveal the Moment They Found Their Foodie Soulmate.
Yeah.
So your wife, Sue Torres, is also a chef. What's that like? What's it like being married to a chef? And what was your soulmate moment?
Well, she's not just a chef. She's a badass chef. And I kind of joke that it's interesting. Like, you know, you're a chef. People want to know about you. But I walk in the room with my wife, it's like I'm not even in the room. Like, she has a wonderful personality. She's very passionate. She's been on everything. She's been on Top Chef Masters, Judge Unchopped. Like, she's the real deal. And we met at a James Beard dinner for Dia de los Muertos, for Day of the Dead. And she was the only chef I didn't know. And she'll say it was because I burnt her. Like, we turned the corner and I burnt her with a sheet tray.
Physically
burnt her. And she's like, I know that you were up to something. It's like, you actually just didn't let me know you were there. So, and then night at PDT. And then I was living in Boston at the time. And we started a long-term relationship. And then sooner or later it became, I would see her like once every couple of weeks, you know, then once a week. And then I was like, yeah, I need to like be near you. And so I moved to New York at the time. And, Anthony Bourdain and about like, you know, accessibility of food. And I think we as chefs, one of the greatest things I share with her is like our just love of food. So we'll go out and I don't need to eat at one of the 50 best restaurants to like enjoy the food. I just got to enjoy the food. And it's the ones that you're with. So like we like pretty much get down and dirty in New York and eat in a lot of like places that are like, I've never heard of that. And it's like, but that's great. It's like we share these experiences together, and to have someone else like that is, she is my culinary and life soulmate. I will say that. She's amazing.
That's awesome. We're going to forward her this little clip. That was very...
That
was
very nice.
That was very nice. Yes. Everybody should have a little on-air moment where they...
I'm slightly weeping.
Aww. Yes. Well. So your last name is Carbone, but you are not actually Italian, and you have been cooking... you know, Mexican food for quite some time now.
Yeah, like probably about 15 years now. I'm adopted from Colombia, and I was raised by Italian Americans in Connecticut, then Long Island. And I have a twin brother. And when my parents came down to adopt us, they said, well, we can split them up or we can keep them together. And so my mom was like, no, we're going to keep them together. Stayed and nursed us back to health for 2 months in Colombia. Doesn't speak any Spanish. And I didn't know anything about my background or anything about being a Latino until I felt like I started to cook. And I was cooking in what I call restaurant purgatory. I was in Ithaca, New York. I'd moved from Boston to Ithaca. And someone, Chris Lee, had done an event and was working for Steven at the time, and they invited me to, you know, come and apply for a job. And so I did, and it came down and trailed. And they were like, well, we have this Mexican concept, Alvez. And I was like, yeah, I don't know anything about that. I've been cooking like local food and like American food. Like, and it was phenomenal. I mean, I had purveyors that were giving me mushrooms with closed gills because they taste better. And so it was amazing. And anyway, so I came down and I fell in love with the idea of what Latin food and what you could do with it. And I've spent the last 15 years of my life like dedicating myself towards that. And I've been lucky enough to not only be able to travel and learn about that food, but like understand who I am as a Latino man through food. And it's pretty powerful for me. And I try to stay grounded in that.
Awesome. Yeah. And so you've been obviously with the Star Group and working with Steven Starr now for, as you said, almost 15 years. Is there
nine? I took a little bit of a hiatus
where you had your own place, right?
Yeah. My wife and I had an offer to open a place up in Connecticut. And so we took, it was like one place in Connecticut and two in St. Thomas. Like, how do you say no to that? You know? So we went, and then unfortunately things didn't work out, but I stayed up there for another couple of years. And then I had worked for Steven for 6 years in Philly. I had left, gone back up to Boston and some time in New York and Connecticut. And then the opportunity presented itself to come back to Alvez. And I took it, and I've been there. It'll be 3 years in October. I'll have been back with the company.
So. Steven is a very well-respected restaurateur. Is there a particular lesson you've sort of learned working for him?
I think more than anything else, there's a couple of things. One of the things that I respect most is like a lot of restaurants. It's like, you know, if you sometimes you got to spend money to make money. And like, he's never questions that because he wants the guest to have a great experience. So like, whatever you need to do, this piece of equipment's going to make the food better, just buy it, you know, like, and it, I mean, it's not an open checkbook, but at the same time, like he always wants the guest to come first. And like, he sets this level of expectation that, so high, and the people around him, help to maintain that, that it's the other thing that I like, that like, it doesn't force you. It pushes you to be better than you were yesterday. And I'm fortunate enough to get to work with people from various different restaurants, because although he has like 40 plus restaurants, they're all different concepts and they're all different ideas of what their goals are and what they're trying to accomplish. But our goal at the end of the day is the same, and to serve great food, to create a great guest experience, and to push yourself as well as the people around you to be the best that they can be. There's nothing wrong with that, you know.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
And Alvez is in Battery Park City, you know, what was once considered removed from the rest of Manhattan. Yeah. What are your thoughts on Hudson Yards? Is it going to work? Is it?
I think because of where it's located, and that's the hottest part of town right now, I feel like. And the Vessel.
It looks like a Trompo.
It looks like a giant Trompo. Yeah, that's true, right? So, I mean, I think that it has the appeal of where it's located. I think that it's at the end of the High Line too, right? Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and it really like butts right up against Chelsea too, right, which is a very popular neighborhood. Yeah. Its location is much greater than what Battery Park was. Battery Park was like at the end of nowhere,
And it's landfill at one time.
It's a peel kind of was, it's beautiful views, yeah. really. Yeah. You're just like at the end.
Yeah. I mean, it's where people go to live, but don't like spend all their time, I feel like, where we are. And we have a giant amount of really important businesses down by us, Goldman Sachs.
Which is the goal of Hudson Yards, too. I mean, they're building so much new office space, and they're working on, I think, what, Condé Nast moved there. And I know they're opening a hotel and more residences.
I feel like Condé Nast is always moving somewhere.
They are.
They were at the
Freedom Tower. Because we're at Battery Park. Yeah.
Yeah, they were there before. Yeah, and we're opening... three spaces in there. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Are electric, we allowed to know?
I don't know the specifics of that. So I'm going to leave a little bit of that.
No, I know that the Equinox Hotel.
Yeah.
Has been
so we're doing
I saw an ad
them.
Run and it said that the food and beverage is being done by Steven Starr.
Yeah. So they're working on some stuff there. And really good accomplished chefs are coming in to work on the projects there. So, yeah, I mean, if Steven's there, he knows something's up. So I would guess everybody else does too. I think it'll do well. And once the shine kind of the newness wears off, I still think as long as the restaurants are good, New Yorkers just want good food. So they'll go.
Yeah.
You know,
how about you? Any special projects?
For myself, I don't know. We're working on something. We have a photo shoot tomorrow we're doing this like special events barbecue. I mean, we worked on it about last summer, at the end of the summer, to do like this like Mexican barbecue kind of thing. And it lends itself to just having like a really good time and being communal. So we're going to do a photo shoot for it tomorrow. And like, it's something that's interesting. It's interesting to work on new things and to keep on pushing yourself to see like what you can do next. It's not about what you did yesterday, or what you're doing now. It's about what you're going to do tomorrow and how you get there, you know? So yeah, we're working on that. And, I have kids, so they keep me ridiculously busy. And I have a wife that I can't even keep up with. And so, you know, there's never enough hours in the day is what I'll basically say about what I have going on.
Yeah. Hey, I got a quick question about Mexican food. You know, as a guy that grew up in New Jersey and moved to California, there was like a major culture shock when I realized that there's like inverse proportions of Italian restaurants to Mexican restaurants.
Right.
Like, it's hard to find an Italian restaurant. There's probably like one per town if you're lucky, but there's several taquerias or whatever. But on the East Coast, it was the other way, where it's really hard to find a Mexican place. But that was years ago. I left like 20 years ago. So what is it like now? Is there a lot of competition in the Mexican restaurant?
Well, I feel like the last 10 years, it's been such a driven concept that it's almost like oversaturated at this point. I mean, I live in Eastern Connecticut, the middle of nowhere, right? And to the south of this, there's like four, like, my wife just consulted in that place, it's right around us, and there's like four more taco joints that are opening, but like upscale.
Huh. Eric, here's the thing. Right. It's all financial, right? There's low food costs in Mexican, and especially in the taco business.
Right.
So once seasoned restaurateurs and restaurant people started to realize they could have a concept that had such good margins, everybody jumped on it. They didn't really care what they did. They were like, we'll figure it out. We'll go find somebody who knows this cuisine and we'll bring them here and we'll do it.
So the margins used to be so great, but now tequila has gone up. Mezcal is very on everybody's mind. Yep. And so all the spirits have gone up.
How about avocados and
limes? That's what I was about to get to.
But that's what happens.
Avocados are ridiculous.
But that's what happens in every market. Pizza also had great margins for a long time until it became a very hot item. And then everything around it starts to become more expensive. Digestives like Fernet and all of those things. Like, all of those things become popular, they become more expensive. This is just American economics in play, right? It's supply and demand. Yep. And
politics. Because like with the avocado market, it's not only driven by the seasonality of the ingredient, but it's also like the last year we encountered things I've never seen before. They weren't picking in the fields, not for any other reason than they wanted to drive up the price of the avocados. And it's the American market, 90% of America's avocados come from Michoacan. And they are smart enough to say, hey, we want our cut too. You know, so it's no longer just about like the fruta loca in that's coming up where there's a shortage of avocados for a couple of weeks. It's year round and we can't control it. And people are still willing to pay the money. I saw somebody they paid $6 for an avocado the other
they
day.
They want you to make their guacamole for them. Well, they don't want to do it themselves. Exactly. Chef, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to our listeners. Don't forget about the 10th anniversary summer drive. New member gifts. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member. Next week is July 4th, but we will be back on the 11th.
Oh, great. Eric, I hope you're putting your pants on now.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm going to take them back off. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Stick around. I believe Taste of the Past is up next.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the food world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.